You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to another damn fine cup of culture. Today is the start of our new summer series, The Summer of Collaboration, in which we all pick a movie collaboration of some sort. Could be directors, could be actors, could be writers, could be anything. And we'll make a series for you to enjoy. And I will be kicking it off today with a very famous classical screen duo. No, it's not Bogie and Bacall. It's Tracy and Hepburn. And to do this, we picked a film, and it's their first film together, their best film together, and their last film together. Tracy and Hepburn famously had an off-screen relationship as well as an on-screen one. Their comedies together were extremely successful, which is also something that bound them even during periods where they might not have preferred that. And that's why I picked this, because it's such an interesting and fascinating classical movie story that's worth a podcast, I think, in its own right. So let's get to the movies immediately. Let's jump right in. Alan, you got the first one. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, so I picked Woman of the Year. And I think the main reason for picking this was when it was suggested as a collaboration, I couldn't remember whether I'd seen this. I was very much thinking, I think I have, maybe, but I'll definitely watch it. And actually watching it, I don't think I had. I think watching it now, it was a very sort of fresh viewing of the collaboration. And, you know, it's first coming together. And I think what struck me instantly is it's almost not a film about them falling in love, because the moment they see each other, you absolutely buy it. They're in love in this film. And then it kind of is a film about them as a couple almost immediately. It's not a romantic film where you have obstacles that might prevent people coming together, and at the end they finally declare their love. They sort of walk in a room and you know their antagonistic personalities, but the moment they've looked at each other, you think, these two people are in love.
Yeah.
And within 5 minutes, the way they're behaving around each other, it's obvious they're in love. There's no, you know, it's not a dramatic device. It's just instantly there on screen, which is quite striking, I think. It's really interesting to see that it was there in this first collaboration. It's there from the outset. This sort of, I like that. I think that first scene where he walks into the room and Catherine Hepburn's already there and they just take each other in is an incredibly interesting scene. I mean, I don't know how, if we're crossing private and personal life, I don't know how you would do that just in acting terms. You'd get two people who maybe didn't really like each other to act that. Might be harder than these two people who probably, this is probably what they were like the first time they saw each other in real life. There's an instant, they're not the same types of people. There's an instant connection. And I thought that was really striking at the beginning of the film. And then you do kind of have to watch the rest of the film.
Well, give us a little bit of as much as it has a plot at all, what's it about apart from the meet cute?
I mean, what is quite interesting, because it sets up the plot of them being antagonistic, that like he's the sort of earthy man of the people and she's the incredibly multilingual posh person. And you think these people are complete opposites. So it's going to be a story of their antagonism. And in a way it is, but it gets them together almost at the beginning. And then it's the story of their antagonism within an established relationship. And it's to some extent, it then is, and this would probably be a recurring motif, it's then Catherine Hepburn being too clever to make a marriage work. Women beware, don't be too smart and highfalutin. Yeah. That feels to be like it's the moral of the film, that she doesn't quite know how to make a marriage work. And the story of the film is her realization of that. And Spencer Tracy is the amiable everyman that, you know, he's doing his best, but ultimately, well, he's saddled with this woman that doesn't quite understand what being a wife is.
Well, he's being wifed. I mean, and he's absurdly sensitive about being wifed, because she has all the parties and the glamour, and he has to sit next to her as the husband, and he hates it. And he has to take her down a notch because, well, I don't know, the film demands it. The ending is as hilarious as it is disingenuous. I don't know. What do you think?
It felt awkward. Oh, God, my God. I started into this movie really enjoying it and really finding it lighthearted and fun when they go to the baseball game. And she somehow gets to know the rules. And then she's one of the guys, you know, someone calls her, "You're like a man now," and calls her pal. And there's these fun scenes, including the party where she speaks all those languages. But then it turns sour in the second half. We're on the side of Spencer Tracy. And to me, by the way, coming as a newbie to these first two movies, I also felt they had a very natural rapport. This was like instantaneous. And for me, who didn't even particularly know about the details of their off-screen relationship, that the fact that they weren't actually an official couple, I felt this was just a natural from the very beginning when he comes to the office and sees her, you know, great legs. And then there's this attraction right away that was there. But I found... then how it turned us against her, that we're supposed to be not rooting for her women's causes and not rooting for her internationalism, globalism, as we would say today, probably, but rather sympathize with him, how he suffers, how the little boy that they adopt suffers, how she doesn't have time anymore, and how somehow the only way out is for her to reduce her career, end her career, change it. And then that awkward scene at the end in the kitchen when she tries to make breakfast and just fails completely at any step of the way.
Domestic task. I know what you mean, Sam, and I feel the same way. But they always get a laugh out of me with a one cup of flour, where she just looks around, gets a coffee cup, puts it in the flour bin, and throws it into the to make the waffles. She's obviously never done this before, and the film needs her to be taken down a notch to such an extent that it becomes both ridiculous and painful to me at points.
Mm-hmm. But it felt for a while like this was the point of the film, to show this extremely successful woman of the year, really interesting context also, middle of World War II. And she's talking at length about the situation going on at the beginning. And I felt, aha, so this is going to be, you know, she's going to be a good companion, a good counterpart to this sports reporter that he is. And I thought, wow, this is going to be a power couple. But then signs of the time, they really tried. And I read about this a little bit, about this final kitchen scene, that they tried to stick this on. It wasn't originally intended, but they tried to somehow appease the Midwestern audience, that of course such a woman would not be able to also be successful at the kitchen. There had to be some kind of failure on her side. Of course she had to be really, really bad at this. And then that was, you know, played for comedy, but against her and against this type of woman that apparently in 1942 was not the desired type in relationships.
No, too cozy. Yeah, too cozy. And it's to me, as a viewer, I love my classic movies, but this obsession with subjugating any strong intellectual woman is just, I could say it's the times, but I don't think that's an excuse. And I sort of lose patience with that type of argument. I think it's just they were too cowardly, as producers are nowadays, as they always were, too cowardly to stick it out and just say, okay, you know what? This is going to be, as you say, the power couple. But no. They have to get her on her knees, and otherwise it doesn't count. It's just a very weird thing.
I mean, it's definitely, you kind of think this is going to get the thumbs up from every producer working at every studio in Hollywood at the time. I mean, this is the sort of, if they had a message, this is the message that the Jack Warners and the Harry Cohens would want to send about, you know, women know your place. And I think it's interesting that, you know, this isn't not long after the Philadelphia Story, that I think plays in a very similar area, but I think I find a lot more forgivable.
Yeah.
The Philadelphia Story does a similar thing of taking, the whole film is almost set up to take Katharine Hepburn down a peg or two. It almost is, almost quite deliberately, her public persona in the, was seen as Katharine Hepburn is too arrogant, she's too good, and almost the Philadelphia.
She's too mannish.
Yeah. And the Philadelphia Story almost exists as a play and then a film, deliberately to almost rebrand her and say, but she has got this side to her, and she has realized that she can be a bit too much.
The softer side. This is why Tracy agreed to appear in Woman of the Year with her, because at that time, the Philadelphia Story was a reboot to Hepburn's career, And he was the big bankable star.
Yeah.
And he, because exactly of what you say, Alan, because of this softer Katharine Hepburn, he agreed to do this romantic comedy with her, this first one, that would lead to so many successes afterwards. And don't get me started on the Philadelphia story, because I will be talking for an hour. That's a very interesting story about how that film got made. I will skip it for now, another day. But it was the Philadelphia story that got Tracy interested in doing Woman of the Year.
It almost feels like, even I'd use the word sequel in the sense that it's not just, oh, here's a softer Katharine Hepburn. It's kind of like saying, you know, you love that film where Katharine Hepburn was taken down a peg or two. Well, we've made another one. It's almost like we've discovered a genre that audiences seem to like, which is, let's take Hepburn down a peg or two, and we're going to make another film of it. And that sort of, you're sort of watching it, and it feels again like sequel diminishing returns. You're watching it going, I've seen this before. I've seen this done better before.
Yeah.
This just feels like the most obvious way of doing it.
And isn't there that literal quote where, I don't know if it's by Mankiewicz or by Tracy, where apparently Katharine Hepburn said that she's almost as tall or taller than Spencer Tracy. And then they said, well, you know, he or I am going to take you down a notch.
Mm.
So there is literally that intention in the making of this film to make sure that she doesn't get as tall or even taller as Spencer Tracy. And that's really the intention behind it. And I feel with those three movies that we're going to discuss, intention and who's behind it is so key. And I feel the writers here, the three men behind this script, apparently had this intention of making that the goal and kind of the way of this character. Show her as this glorious woman, the way she's dressed, the way she interacts, all the connections she has, but then show her as a raven mother and a selfish human being who does it all in the end for her prize of Woman of the Year, and then realizes how empty that feels once she has that prize. So, I mean,
this
how
should
is
have been made about
feel?
Men. I mean, honestly, there is a lack of self-awareness in the gentleman who produced this, is that this is basically a film about a man which has been gender switched with a woman, right? Because this, oh, the ambition is so empty, blah, 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 and I don't have love in my life. This is not a female storyline.
Mm-hmm. And it's almost a Taming of the Shrew adapted.
It's Taming of the Shrew.
To that story. I feel that's so present in that script.
Yeah, and the story you referred to, Sam, it's really cute. I've heard several versions of it where they first met and Katharine Hepburn apparently looked him up and down and said something to the effect of, isn't he a little bit short? Either that or she said, I'd better take off my heels. That's a story that crops up every now and again about the meet cute between the real Katharine Hepburn and the real Spencer Tracy.
I think especially it is the saving grace of this film. I mean, if you start recasting it with people that didn't have that chemistry, this wouldn't be a good film at all.
No, and it's a film about class as much as it is about gender. I mean, I think that's what saves it, is that this is a commentary on the salt of the earth sports journalist and the really highfalutin diplomat writer journalist. The fact that it is about class as much as it is about gender makes it more palatable than it would have been otherwise, I think.
Mm-hmm. And the ending cushions it a little bit. I think what Spencer Tracy says, which is much to his credit, is that, you know, he doesn't want her to be the housewife, what she attempts and clearly fails at and probably would need a lot of change in her life to really be able or willing to do that. She shouldn't be just the hard-edged career woman that she was at the beginning. He says something to the effect of, why can't you be the real Tess Harding Craig at this point? So he somehow balances it a little bit with that line where you feel, okay, he gives her the option of being something in between to make the relationship work. But it's, of course, on her to make those changes, not on him.
And she first has to subjugate herself to his annoyance and his anger, and then he gets to forgive her.
Mm-hmm. Humiliation first, forgiveness after.
It's very magnanimous of him. I mean, that's sort of like, and again, I think that would go down well with the sort of male Hollywood producer audience that's sort of like, we can fix this because we can be magnanimous at the end of any problem with women. That's how, you know, as long as we, and it's, yeah, it just genuinely, when I was watching it, I was thinking, if this was a couple that had no chemistry, by this point, this film would be painful to watch. And you get by because of that chemistry, you understand, I think you instinctively pick up that there is a kindness there. There is an attraction between whatever's going on between the two of them that I'm not sure the script really necessarily wants to put there. I think the script just let's knock Katharine Hepburn down a peg or two and then have the guy come in to save the day by being wise and magnanimous. Mm-hmm. And I think if it was just that as the bare bones, it would be a horrible film. I think I absolutely buy that Katharine Hepburn would feel I'm in love with him, so I'm willing to try to change. That feels a more palatable way of presenting that idea. You suddenly, on a personal level, you sort of buy it. And again, Spencer Tracy's, he's magnanimous, but you also think he is reaching out, he is caring. And that you only get that sentiment because there is that chemistry. Mm-hmm.
I would argue it only works because it's those two, because it's Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, because he's so likable. Yeah. And she, in her sometimes shrewd manner, sometimes very charming, very self-confident, she's also so likable in the way she is. But it's almost as if we're looking at the, not the characters in the film, but just the fact that it's Katharine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy. And I think that's a little bit true for all three films, that we're almost thinking in terms of them just as the Hollywood stars on screen and not really at this Sam Craig and Tess Harding that, as you say, acted by others, would be very different and have a very different effect.
Well, that's a good bridge for me. Let's switch it over to a film where I think it does work a little bit better than Woman of the Year, which is my personal favorite, which I brought, which is Adam's Rib, in which Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy play a married couple. He is a public attorney. She is a defense counsel. Can you see where this is going already? There is a huge case with lots of media in which a wife shoots at her husband, wounding him, but not killing him. And of course, now he has to prosecute her. And she gets all cozy and makes it a women's lib issue and decides, come hell or high water, I'm defending her. Hijinks inevitably ensue. And the reason I love this film is because the dialogue is just phenomenally good. I mean, I can still see them sitting on the bed together and her opening a newspaper and almost like a caricature of herself exclaiming, hot dog. I mean, who talks this way? And yet it feels completely natural. I believe Katharine Hepburn didn't like to swear and just talked like that. But it's a couple that's believable and the dialogue is wonderfully done. Of course, the movie itself is a really big circus. They make this courtroom like almost a theater with some lovely jokes in there. And I think the plot line is about the same as Woman of the Year. Katharine Hepburn needs to be taken down a peg, and she does, you know, in the end. He is magnanimous and decides to forgive her for, I have no idea what. To me, with my modern eyes, he seems to be absurdly sensitive to everything she does. And he suspects her of even cheating when there's no reason in the wide world why he should. But okay, let's put it on the times again. Apparently this is more understandable if you're an old-timey person. But to me, he just seems absurdly sensitive. Anyway, she is very sorry about everything she did not do wrong and decides to ask for his unnecessary forgiveness, which he then magnanimously bestows upon her. So that's about the same thing. But I think this film works better because it has more attention to detail. It has more jokes. It has Judy Holliday, which is a redeeming feature in any film that she's in, and also worth a podcast of her very own. And so I think it works rather better. But I don't know. What did you think?
Well, in my mind, going back to the intention and who's behind it, I think one clearly senses that someone else is behind it, wrote this and who directed this with very different intention. Here it's one of my favorite actresses of all time who didn't become an actress until very late in life, Ruth Gordon, and her husband at the time, Garson Kanin or Cannon, who's the brother of Michael Caine, who wrote Woman of the Year, apparently. And that I found was very, it felt very authentic in the sense of that a couple had written that and that a woman had been part of the process of creating a woman character. And I feel that dynamic between them is so well created in the film from the very beginning. There's such a great energy and rapport between them. And even though there's also some traces of, like you said, the woman needs to ask for forgiveness for her behavior, there is certainly, it works much better. And I think there's so much more about the actual equality seen on screen and actual equality of talents and of tricks of the trade how there's this back and forth in court, this literal circus that you mentioned before, that they bring in and try to somehow top each other in those moments and get the media attention in different ways. So I think to me, that was clearly visible also with George Cukor directing here.
Yeah.
I think that was a very different tone and a very different benevolence towards these issues that were talked about, not just the sneer at, you know, women's lib and how absurd that is and how shallow it is in the end.
Mm.
Remember the aunt in Woman of the Year who gets married at the end and gives up her position because she always wanted to get married. Terrible.
Yeah.
And here I feel it's genuine with these women characters that are brought in into court, even those different types to prove her point. And I think there's still strong points concerning women can have a career and women can be that strong.
And I think, but you can correct me if I'm wrong, but Garson Kanin is also politically rather left-leaning personality. And I think that in the political sense that this movie is, you know, about the position of women and the unjustness with which women are approached unequally to men, sometimes stated, sometimes clearly true, seems to be one of those liberal viewpoints that sort of translates pretty well in this film, where it's sort of lacking in Woman of the Year, where they don't particularly have an agenda. They just want her on her knees for a little bit. And here it seems like, okay, here's a political point that could be argued from both sides. You could argue that she goes too far and makes it into a complete spectacle. You could also argue that he's wrong for, you know, just not supporting her in her very obvious success. You know, he resents her for being accomplished. And I think that that is clear in the film, is that he's, at some point, he's just being really childish and mopey and impossible. Because Kip is a friend of the family and he's very obnoxious and wants to be the provocateur all the time and can't shut up. And he's supposed to be annoying. But Tracy's character seems to be annoyed beyond all reason, just because this guy can't shut his trap. And it's made clear that he's just being silly now, right? It's not just her being provocative. It's also him being absurdly sensitive to every perceived slight from her or anyone else.
And there's this great scene, I think, that gives her such powerful arguments also in court. You know, one that seems silly at first when they superimpose the three main characters on the stand,
yes,
and turn them into the opposite gender.
They gender swap them, yeah.
Gender swap, which is ingenious and such a fun idea, but it also proves her point. We would look at the case differently if the roles were switched and if it was the woman cheating her husband and he would go out and try to shoot her or at least attempt. So I think there's really good points that they make that are fun for the film, but also make a strong point for her cause. And I think that's a big difference to the first film.
Softened by, and I'm going to repeat this, Judy Holliday is the shooter, so the lady who shoots her husband. And she is so good because Katharine Hepburn is this really sophisticated patrician counselor. And she has to talk to this woman who just is half aware of what's happening to her. And after she tells this entire story about how she got up and how she went, got the gun and got the instructions with it for free, then followed her husband and then just blindly shot into the void. And she's asked, how did you feel after that? And she looks very innocently and says, hungry. I mean, she is beyond fabulous in this. And if she hadn't been so good, I'm not sure that they would have pulled off quite that tightrope walk that they do with the court scenes. I think she's, especially in the beginning, again, at the end, it sort of peters out because we have to get our point that Hepburn has to pipe down for the marriage to work. But it works so well for such a long time.
And isn't that moment that I think what I find interesting about this film, and especially when what you've been saying about the background and the writing of it, is that sort of final scene that takes her down, it does feel like a coda that's been added on. So I think when you watch the court case, I think not only does, like, spoiler, Katharine Hepburn win, but I think as an audience, you know it's right that she won.
Mm-hmm.
I think it very much sets you up. And it does this thing which I think feels maybe it was speaking a lot about how marriages work at that time. That on the political sphere, in the social sphere, we have this idea about equality. We have this idea that these are great principles. But at the end of the day, for a marriage to work, yeah, the woman's got to be taken down a peg or two. And it sort of feels like it's playing the two things. It wants to have, we're progressive, but at the end of the day, on a personal level, maybe that just needs to be tempered slightly. And so that feels like this weird sort of coda at the end. And the other thing I sort of love about this film, or really speaks of its time, is that they're married from the off. They're a convincing married couple in this film. And it sort of feels to me like that is probably the way cinema audiences were going, that it wasn't anymore the sort of young genre that was scandalizing and outraging people or, you know, encouraging bad behavior. It's become the genre that millions of couples will go and see, like married people. We'll go see a film. And it sort of reflects almost that it's settled down. It's learned to accept the production code. It's not going to scare the horses or anything. It's just going to be a very, and in this case, an incredibly well-written, witty script that caters to this now fundamental audience to cinema, the sort of white married people who they've settled down a little bit. They're not old yet. And this is their film. This is the film that if they were looking for something to go see, they'd go see this and it would deliver. And on that level, for them personally, that message of, yeah, we're living in a more progressive age, but at the end of the day, it's the woman that's going to be doing most of the housework. That exactly would have reflected the audience. This would have been them. They would have been the husbands going, you know, ultimately, I agree with you, but you need to take yourself down a peg or two for this marriage to work. And that it seems such a zeitgeist film in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's also one of those very rare films that makes marriage look sexy. It's not about husbands with roving eyes or domestic abuse or whatever. This is a good marriage. We sense this from the outset. We're rooting for them because the relationship works on screen and we want them to figure it out and not be so stupid, right? This is what works. And as you say, Alan, absolutely, it's written beautifully. The dialogue is absolutely gorgeous.
And all those scenes in between, whenever the court case ends and they go home, and there's this evening where she gives him a massage, he gives her a massage, until, of course, things go wrong and someone slaps the other and then the fight starts. But there's always these domestic scenes or relationship scenes in between where you feel this is not just about the case. Obviously, there's tension building because of it, but they also have a fabulous life together. And I think that's endangered somewhat by that competition between them. But it also shows, no, there is potential that that will turn out well. And Alan, you talked about the ending. I think there's such a good point about that. This is made for couples, this film, because the ending oscillates so well between her and his position. That big fight they have at the end, including Kip, then the divorce, the separation, then Spencer Tracy's tears, which we genuinely feel for. And I think, wow, he's now a man who's emotionally broken by this, her, of course, feeling just like us. Then it turns out that maybe those tears were fakes. We don't quite know. And then in the end, it feels like she wants to, what is it she wants to say? Well, maybe if you become the Republican.
No, that really saves the ending for me. He gets a nomination for being the Republican candidate.
On the court judge, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And she puts on her hat and says, do they need anyone for the Democratic Party?
Exactly. And how beautiful is that? And then they want to start fighting. And I think the last thing, and I was a little bit ambiguous about that, the last thing I think is pretty much that, you know, he shuts her up and then this little curtain closes and the film is over. So literally until the very end, you don't quite know which position wins out. It seems at the end that somehow he ends it by just, you know, kissing her and then the film romantically somehow goes off into the ending. But it remains very much in this up and down position until the very end. And it's so well done.
Yeah, she doesn't have to give up because in the Woman of the Year with the ending, Spencer Tracy's character grants her the freedom to be at least partly herself. In this film, she takes it. And she means it as a half a joke. She's just, you know, irritating him on purpose. But she gets to keep her identity. I think that is essential, even though the conflict works out the way that it should in a traditional film. These little things sort of saves the movie from being overly, I don't know what the word is, trite.
And there's a coda to that. She is also better in the kitchen at the same time. I watched, of course, her cooking skills in this one, and she is very well able to put together at least a meal from different items in the fridge. and to create something in a pan. So I think they also are a little bit balanced on that, you know, can a woman who is as successful and is in that court case, can she also do the work at home? And I think they give a little bit of a more realistic and fair treatment of that.
Yeah. And I keep laughing because when he knows he's in the wrong, he starts bandying about the law as he's an attorney. And he keeps saying, you can't play fast and loose with the law, which basically just means shut up, Kate. It has nothing to do with the law. You know, can't you be normal and just be at home and mix me a drink, for goodness sakes?
But again, I wonder how much this reflects the sort of relationship in real life, is that I think why this works as a married couple is even in their bickering, it feels like it's a game between the two of them. That the foundation is that this is two people who genuinely love each other. So even when they're sniping at each other, it doesn't feel like the sniping, the end game of this sniping is the marriage is going to end. The sniping is part of the marriage. Mm. This is how they're together. This is part of the fun of being a couple.
Yeah.
And again, you sort of think of other movie couples and just think, if you'd cast Bogart and Bacall in this, it just wouldn't have worked. They could not have done that sense of they are chiding each other, but it's genuinely part of who they are. It is part of the fun. And that, I think Sam made a good point about the, you know, they're married, but it's fun. And Hollywood, to some extent, because it ends films with the marriage, it's not very good with that. And I mean, I always give the sort of example that if you watch like the Thin Man films in a row with William Powell and Myrna Loy, they just domesticate Myrna Loy. And by the end, it's so disappointing that like the character in the first film, the only way they can make her work as a wife is to make her just the domesticist of wife who continually rolls her eyes at her husband's stupidity.
Yes, they make her into a nag.
And it's such a shame. And I think what's quite interesting in this film suddenly is like, we're going to give you a married couple that will seem credible and real because the bickering, the arguments are part of it. Mm. But it's not a counteraction there. It still feels like they're enjoying the happy ever after that came at the end of the film where they got married. This is a really sort of fun married couple. And there's not many of those.
Yeah. And it appears, or at least I've read, that it was true in real life to the extent that Spencer Tracy was the only person who could get Kate to actually shut up. That's the story. Because,
well, why is that worth mentioning? Poor Kate. Why do you need to shut her up?
Because I think, as I said before, these comedies work as class comedies as much as they do in the sense of gender issues. It's not just that she's a woman, he's a man. It's obviously that she comes from a very patrician background and he does not. And this is a component of these comedies that keeps sort of, it keeps them from aging too badly. It's a bit qualified here because, of course, they are old-fashioned. Because this is also a comedy about class and class distinction. And Katharine Hepburn was, of course, a very patrician American lady with a huge family. And I think her dad was an internist, some sort of medical doctor, and the family was very chaotic. And I remember a bit about Howard Hughes, poor man, who was her real-life lover, and he was invited to dinner with that family. He was half deaf. She kept shouting over everyone. He was very awkward and confused and angry and didn't want to go. It's that sort of what you, almost stereotypical patrician family, complete with big house and the chintzy sofas. And this works because this is who Katharine Hepburn in part actually is. And we sense that this is not just about her being a woman, him being a man, but also her background as this patrician woman who just thinks that she deserves success and she deserves what's coming to her. And she's probably right, but he can't take it because it's his privilege being bruised all the time, which is just hard for him because he's this salt of the earth guy. Or in Spencer Tracy's words, I'm a mug. I should play mugs because I look like one.
I mean, they're definitely, with these films, and especially the first two, they are bringing their sort of showbiz persona, which was very close to their actual persona. And that is the character they play in the film. It's like designing the film is like, we want a Spencer Tracy type to play this role. He's salt of the earth. He's got a heart of gold, but he's a bit of a mug. He's a bit of a bruiser. Spencer Tracy. And so it's almost designed in the sense that the public would have had this pre-existing preconceptions about these characters, these actors, and the roles that they're famous for playing.
Right, exactly.
You're sort of creating the film, which puts them up against each other. And especially with this one, you do a really good job of it. The way they play against each other plays so well into how you would expect the two to play off against each other.
Right.
That it kind of is sort of delivering, like you said, it's a circus, but it's people would see the poster for this film and hope it would be the film that they get. It's the two of them sparring, being funny, from these very different backgrounds.
Right, and she gets to be, this is going to sound shallow, but one of the strengths of the film is that Katharine Hepburn gets to be proper fabulous. It's the same thing that makes the Philadelphia story with its, pardon me, but idiot plot work so well, is she gets to be proper fabulous, and you just believe that she gets what she wants because she's her. And the first time she walks into a guy who says, no, you can't, she's flabbergasted. What do you mean I can't? I can have anything I want, right? And as long as she gets to be really, really fabulous, we believe everything. She's a great comedian, of course. This is just believable, right? It's believable that someone like Kip, the house friend, who is, I think, coded as gay.
He is, yeah. I thought, why is he hitting on her?
All over her. Why is he all over her? Is she supposed to be his beard? No, we get the clue at the end of the film. He tells her, in so many words, that it's so convenient to have a lover across the hall because you don't have to go into the rain all the time. This is what Kip thinks like.
I know that I was right because I felt that all the time. And then I thought, why is he now supposed to be cornering her and wanting to start a relationship at the end if he's so obviously, fabulous from the beginning, this pianist who cracks jokes. And yeah, so I also felt that was pretty
very
obvious.
Heavily coded. It's an interesting part, and the actor has such fun with it as well.
Mm-hmm. But why wouldn't you want to be around the fabulous Katharine Hepburn and have a relationship with her anyway? Because if you have her across the hall, that's all you need,
yeah.
Right?
And also, of course, and this is all untrue, but gossip at the time was that she was gay. People were like, you can't be a woman in trousers, let alone yellow trousers, behaving the way she does, and be a heterosexual woman, which of course you can, and she was. Well, we don't know how she would have identified nowadays because these are different times and we have more freedom. But, you know, there is a sort of undertone of gossip in which Tracy was also gay and they were each other's beard. I mean, the ridiculousness of the homophobia in those days, and then to have a Kip who is going to be heterosexual out of sheer convenience because he doesn't want to stand out in the rain with his fabulous hat, sort of is all of a... it's offensive. I know it's offensive and I shouldn't laugh, but it's all of a type, isn't it?
That's zeitgeist again.
Yeah. And I think it gives you sort of an insight into sort of how four-dimensional gossip can be with celebrity couples, because there was this thing that their romance was, like you said, they were beards for each other. That this was a part of the gossip was discovering they were a couple, because it was never officially announced. And people would go, oh,
no, it was a secret.
But it was sort of like, it felt like an open secret. People generally knew that they were lovers. They were a couple in real life.
His wife certainly knew.
She must have.
And so you have this sort of open secret in the gossip, in the world of gossip. But then the open secret then has extra levels of gossip on it where people go, well, it can't be this simple. Maybe this is actually the gossip we hear about them being a couple. That's what we're being fed, because there's something more here. There's something, they're both hiding secrets. And especially Katharine Hepburn, who the sort of illusion that she was a lesbian sort of followed her from, like you said, the earliest days in trousers. It really was sort of always felt about her. And it almost seems too convenient that I think the gossip would have felt that there's this very all-American, no-nonsense guy. Oh, they're a couple. That's not the type of person you'd kind of assume Katharine Hepburn would go
suspect
for a kid.
Mm-hmm. And imagine what box office gold that must have been for producers to know that they can bank on that.
A little caveat here, because I think at the time, if I try to put myself back there and what the media were about there, I think that her most highly publicized relationship was the one with Howard Hughes. There were always speculations, when are they going to get married? Will they, won't they? That sort of thing. And I think back in those days, that might have been the larger sort of big romance. right? Because she was, of course, very athletic and very strong, and he was this aviator, pilot person, and very rich. So I sometimes wonder whether the Tracy Hepburn dynamic, of course, Hollywood knew, but did it really trickle down to the public to such an extent that they would project it on those films? Or were they still in the mind space of, oh, fabulous Katharine Hepburn with her fabulous rich stable of lovers, because she had a great many, so did he. And I think he had an affair with, was it Loretta Young? Which was very widely publicized, even though he was married and he had a kid. So it's hard for me to know from looking in retrospect what would have had, what would have overshadowed what. Which scandal was the scandal of the day at the time, Adam's Rib? Who was having an affair with whom? Who had been seen with whom in which nightclub? So it's hard to know. The gossip is so amorphous and so dynamic. It's, I'm not even sure that with Adam's Rib, people would have projected the Tracy Hepburn affair onto the film.
I think, you know, it's sort of intriguing to sort of think about doing the research and just going to the gossip columns. But then the gossip columns had such a code then as well that, like, people reading them, like, you could have read them, and to some people, especially Hollywood people, it would have been obvious that this meant that they were a couple. But other people would just read it and think, oh, they're getting on very well shooting a film. That's nice, because they look like friends. And you know, how, like I said, this sort of four-dimensional chess of gossip, it is really intriguing. I think the only thing I would say is that the chemistry on screen is so palpable. And I think you get the other way around. You get people that assume if two people on film have good chemistry, something must be happening.
Well, see Loy and Powell, right? So everybody keeps thinking
they thought they were married,
that they had a relationship in real life.
And so it's erroneous, but people probably would have erroneously picked up that they were a couple just because how good the chemistry is on screen. They would have just thought, well, they must be. They must.
Yeah.
And you perceive them as this couple. I think that's what struck me with those three films, that they're, from the beginning on, you think, well, this is a couple that gets to know each other. They're quite young. A little bit later, they're in this marriage in Adam's Rib. And they made a total of 9 films together then in the end. So it must have worked out in terms of the box office and people wanting to see that dynamic on the screen again and again, especially in the 40s and 50s.
It linked them together because they were so wildly successful. Interestingly, just to finish my tangent for a bit, like all Hollywood gossip, the secret, the real secret, was another one, and that was his drinking. He was constantly having to be picked up by a custom-made Warner Brothers ambulance to hide from public view that he'd been on a bender. That was the cover-up. It had nothing to do with extramarital affairs. It had something to do with the fact that he had serious, serious issues.
Mm-hmm. And wasn't Katharine Hepburn, wasn't she also assigned partly by producers to control a little bit his drinking because they knew about it and she was thought of to be someone who's able to, you know, tame him down a little bit in terms of his excesses?
As far as I know, she was, at least in the beginning, rather against him quitting completely. She thought he should just control it. But the problem with this dude was that he would be on the wagon for months, for years. Then he'd have to have 2 drinks, disappear for a week, and be found lying on the sprawled on the floor in some Mexican bar or other, right? So I'm not sure whether, of course, they will have whispered in her ear, try and see what you can do with him. But I think the sort of major interventions were usually the studios, where they at some point told him, either you get sober or you're fired. I think when he changed to Fox, I'm doing this off the top of my head. If I'm wrong, I apologize. But he switched studios at some point and they just told him, if you misbehave, you are finished. And as I said, he had a wife and a child, and his child was deaf. His son was deaf, and his wife, so his actual wife, legal wife, had one of those charitable institutions for deaf children. And that institution ran on his fame and his money. So there's another reason why he couldn't just lose his job and his star power. So he was stuck, not just because of his Catholicism, which is widely known that he was a Catholic and that's why he didn't want a divorce, but also for very pragmatic reasons. So I'm not sure whether Katharine Hepburn, even if she was asked, could have done anything, because it was just the situation that he was in that he couldn't just say, okay, look, sort of Hollywood, because it's making me ill and it's threatening my sobriety and I have to get away from here. It was just not possible for him.
Well, maybe that gives me a good segue to the third movie that we're going to talk about, because by the time that this movie comes around, almost 20 years after Adam Zarib, Spencer Tracy, of course, is very ill. I'm not sure to what extent his, you know, previous habits had to do with it, but he was certainly thought to be very ill and maybe too ill to complete that film even. And I think the drama around the film, around the making of, was always, will he make it? Will he be able to finish it? I think the studio was even very nervous around him doing the film. And Katharine Hepburn, of course, was very supportive that he would be able to do it. And I think she even did without a salary, and so did the director. I'm not quite sure. I read something around the making of that they even invested so that he could be part of the film.
Well, I know that they worked around him because his energy would flag, of course, because he was a heart patient.
Exactly.
And they were apparently all prepared to just work around him and make sure that he could do his scenes to the best of his ability.
Apparently some of the actors were even playing not against Spencer Tracy in some scenes, but against just a replacement person who was there.
Oh, really?
So I read about that. So anyway, the film we're talking about, maybe you would have guessed, is Guess Who's Coming for Dinner. 1967, it was released 14 days after they finished shooting Spencer Tracy was dead. So it came out, it was released just after his death. And he was even posthumously nominated for an Oscar, Best Actor. Katharine Hepburn got the Oscar as Best Actress for that film. And it's, of course, if we talked about zeitgeist in those films, it's a very, very different zeitgeist by the time this movie comes around.
It's a tough movie.
A tough movie. We're in the late 60s, but not quite the Summer of Love yet, and not quite 1968, even though there are clear signs how this film tries to deal with youth culture and music of the time, and of especially the demands of the younger generation and how they want to live. So basically, it's this young couple returning to San Francisco. He's a doctor. He's an African-American doctor. She's a young white girl from a upper-scale, upper-class background. They drive to her parents' house, and she tells him, you know, my parents are great. They're very liberal. They will be okay with that, and very happy to meet you. And of course, the parents are Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy. And the whole film is basically around the drama that then ensues from them meeting Dr. Prentice, Sidney Poitier.
The fabulous Sidney Poitier.
The fabulous Sidney Poitier, who just came off Lilies of the Field and obviously also In the Heat of the Night that same year. And who is Dr. Prentice? Of course, a very likable, very beautiful character as well, and how he takes in that situation skeptically to see what would happen. And here, Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy are this aged couple. So it feels again as if over the years we've seen the same couple growing up and now having this daughter played by, I think, Katharine Hepburn's niece, Katherine Houghton, or Houghton.
Oh, are they related? I didn't even know that.
Yeah, I was surprised to find that out. And my first thought was, now talking about these two other films, isn't that also a film about taking her down a notch from her haughty ambitions of thinking that marrying a African-American doctor is going to be okay with society and with her parents? And that's my starter question here, maybe to you. How was your take on the film now, rewatching it? It seems very progressive at the time, but how does it rob us these days watching it?
Yeah, I said at the very beginning of this podcast, I lose patience with the argument that context forgives everything. Of course, context is very important, but rewatching this film, and I've seen it several times, it is cringe. I'm sorry. Sidney Poitier, apart from being one of the most impossibly beautiful people to ever grace the screen and one of the most charismatic, is ostensibly in this movie, an incredibly accomplished doctor who does charity work. I think he half invented the cure for cancer. This man is perfect. And here's my problem. You have an African-American character, and of course he has to be perfect. He has no flaws. He's not allowed to have any flaws. Why? Because he is a person of color. This, I find it impossible to see through the perfect black gentleman trope. I can't deal with it, and it's the film's fault. This is softened slightly by the acting of Hepburn and Tracy. They are really worthwhile watching in this movie because they do so well. When she is told, when Katharine Hepburn is told by her daughter that she is engaged and Hepburn sees Poitier, she is not so much angry as she is heartbroken. She is actively sad about this. She's not, I don't know, miffed somehow, or how dare you. She's just like, oh my, this is going to lead to so much trouble in the future. This is her, you know, and I can sort of deal with that. But the perfect gentleman trope is painful to me. And I can't watch through it, even now.
I mean, I agree with you. It's weirdly, I think, the hardest film to watch of the three. I think because of exactly what you say. And I think it follows on to the comment with the previous films that, you know, this is... These are films that would get the nod from the Jack Warners, the studio executives. They'd go, okay, we can live with these politics. We're happy with these politics. And I think this shows that by about this year, this is about as far as they're willing to go when it comes to race. It's sort of like, okay, we could possibly accept this if the guy is perfect. You know, there's no... It is... That, you know, it's the very least they could do, almost. But it kind of feels like that's the sort of idea that, especially black entertainers, people who were racist, the racist powerful people, will go, well, I can't be racist because I like Sammy Davis Jr.
Yeah, oh god, yeah.
There is this, I think, this feeling that sort of like this makes people who are racist feel they're not that racist. It feels to be like catering to that. And I think at the same time, you have got a genuine sort of liberal sentiment behind this film. They're trying to do the right thing. And I wouldn't be entirely cynical that the point may have landed with some of the people watching in America, that this could have worked. This could have changed people's minds. But I think ultimately what it feels like now is it just illustrates where the powerful people in Hollywood were and how far they were willing to accept this, which isn't that far.
And the nasty bit is, I think it is, like you say, I think it's really, it is well-meaning. This is what they thought was a well-meaning film about race in America. And this is what they come up with. I mean, it really, I don't have the vocabulary to discuss race in America because I will go nauseous because it's such a difficult, fraught subject. And especially in Hollywood. But then you have a character like Poitier and Spencer Tracy being the biggest bigot ever. And he's supposed to be likable. I have such cognitive dissonance about this movie, even though I can objectively see that the acting, as far as Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn is concerned, is great. They are wonderful together. But this just, it reeks all the more because it is well-meaning, or supposed to be well-meaning, nominally. Virtue signaling par excellence.
I'm partly there with you. I do see that very strongly in the film as well, and especially this time around. And there are these scenes, I think it's even commented on, that Sidney Poitier even leaves, you know, he's so good, he even leaves money to make a long-distance phone call. And apparently that's not the only film in which he did that. So there's certainly these details that add to the perfection. Also the fact that his parents, of course, are also so extremely likable when they come around, and of course are a kind of a mirror image to Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy. And
oh, his mom is precious. Mm, yeah,
she's precious. But then at the same time, I have to say there is an element to it that I always enjoy about it. It is, of course, the drama and contradiction that this film lives off, that there are these characters like Spencer Tracy, who is such a bigot, but he's also called out as this. And I think that one character that I think is so brilliantly placed there is Monsignor Ryan. You know, the Catholic priest that comes around, and he really talks truth to power, in quotation marks. He really points that out and vocalizes it. And partly also Poitier and, of course, Catherine Houghton as the daughter. There are these moments where there is great conflict around these issues and where Spencer Tracy realizes, or at least starts to question himself, the way he feels. Again, I would say it's ruined by the ending, where I feel
the monologue,
Spencer Tracy's sermon at the end, you know, he's the priest then who makes the final decision. Everyone's in suspense and says, oh my God, what is Father going to say? And then they walk to dinner, the dinner that is always talked about, we never actually see. I find that very enjoyable still about the film, that even though it's not quite there yet, but it seems like it's very much in the process of bringing in those voices. Also, Tilly with her weird sense of what's wrong with this.
Yes.
Dr. Prentice.
Very old.
He cannot be real because his doctor title must be fake. He's one of those African-Americans who, of course, are fakes and they're ruined the cause from before. There seems to be a diversity of voices there. And I feel even though the voices are imbalanced at the end and they land wrongly at the end, maybe also for the sake of Spencer Tracy and this final role, there is a lot going on. I find it a very interesting in-between movie.
Well, I'm sorry to be contrary, but quite apart from the impossible race problem with this film, the paternalism. I mean, talk about your Katharine Hepburn being taken down a notch. She sits there, clasping her hands at the ending, waiting for his judgment to fall upon this family. And even from Poitier's character, the way he is written, is that he decides that he needs Spencer Tracy's blessing or he will not marry the daughter. The paternalism. I don't even need race for this to be a problematic movie. I try to like this movie and I try to appreciate it for what it tries to do. But every corner I turn with this, I run into huge creep out yuck issues. And I can't help it. And I try to be tolerant of this. But even just the purely the impossible paternalistic attitude of both the Monsignor, who seems very grabby for a priest, by the way, of Spencer Tracy's character and of Poitier's character. Even if you take that away, it's so conservative. I can't even.
I mean, I would say as a sort of weird defense that paternalism is part of the brand. I mean, across these films, and I think if you go across all the Spencer Tracy films, underlying them all is paternalism. And what I think is quite interesting about this film, and I don't sort of, it's setting a low bar for achievement. So I'm not sure whether, you know, we should set it that low. But I think there is something in this film that they were a couple on screen that I think a lot of people identified with, that there was something about them. They, you know, they kept coming back as couples. They were popular. I think there would have been a broad sentiment that said, people said, oh, we're like them. We'll go see the new Tracy Hepburn film because we like them as a couple. They remind us of us when they're bickering, but they love each other. We'll go see them. And to sort of take that brand and at least have a vague sentiment that they go, and this couple you like, they stop being bigots. At the end of the film, they're not bigots. I mean, that feels like it's trying to do something. And it is clearly going to be paternalistic, but that's the brand. You were never going to have this couple telling a film without it ending with someone being taken down a peg or two and the man being ultimately, you know, he needs to be magnanimous at the end.
And forgive everybody for sins they have
exactly,
not committed.
Exactly, because that's what they do in all these films. That's the formula.
But again, that's the ending. That's a terrible ending. I still feel that there is merit to the fact that there are these other scenes as well. I'm thinking of her friend or her colleague, Hillary, who comes around just to look, just to gossip or be able to get some more detail on the gossip. And Katharine Hepburn has a great scene sending her off and getting rid of her altogether because she can't deal with this kind of bigotry and quite overt racism as well. So there is development and they question themselves as being bigots. I find just, again, just with all the three scripts, it depends on what your intention is, then at the end, what the final takeaway is. And I think there the movie goes wrong, but I still feel there are a lot of these very likable moments where I feel, aha, the conversation is there. And I, of course, we're looking at these films from present day eyes, but me as, you know, with always history in the background, I'm also trying to see where does this film come out? It comes out literally at the time when the Supreme Court ends the ban on mixed race marriages in 14 states that still existed. And the film mentions in the dialogue that their relationship in 14 states would still be illegal. By the time the film comes out, this is gone. So you can see how the film sits awkwardly in between where this is still a reality when it's made, but it's no longer when the film is released. Doesn't that say everything about the film and how it's, again, producers probably tried to fit it in somewhere between a potentially conservative audience that they didn't want to piss off, and on the other hand, a very liberal, progressive America that was certainly becoming more influential and ending the societal realities that the film still had to include because they were there. But it's as I said, I feel it's sitting on a fence.
Yes, this is probably also... You're probably right, Sam, and that's probably also what makes it so awkward because it tries to have it both ways. I mean, we are supposed to like the bigots, but we're supposed to root for Poitier too. I don't know. And again, I think also the film makes life difficult for itself in the sense that this is such a fraught topic. I mean, here we are in the 21st century. We're much more modern, at least nominally. And I can't even think to find the words to describe what yucks me out about this film, because it's just hard and difficult and complicated and has a history that goes back for centuries.
And I mean, even a sort of cinematic history, because we're sort of talking about the laws that were in America, but obviously the production code forbade presenting mixed race couples. I mean, Hollywood had been in on this more than it needed to be. It hadn't addressed this before because it very much felt, we're not going to. We are just not going to present this on screen. It's not something we want to do. And, you know, it sort of feels like, okay, we will do it now because ideas have changed. And they do it in the most lightweight way possible. I mean, it is the very least they could do. But I suppose it isn't, because the very least they could do would be nothing and to continue the status quo. So I think there's something interesting that they go, well, we kind of need to address this. And I think it sort of feels like almost Hollywood dipping the toe. They've played it safe for so long, and then they're just going, oh, well, maybe we can get away with it if we make him perfect. And we show the audience that you can relate to these people, this married couple, because they're bigots like you. But look at the end, they've learned not to be bigoted. This is kind of the story they want. They want to tell the bigot story, because they're never going to tell a story of an actual black lead character. That's not going to happen. But they will tell the story of a couple of bigots not being so bigoted anymore.
Yeah, but isn't it telling that we're talking about a Hollywood in which one of the biggest productions ever was Gone with the Wind with this racist nostalgia torch? I have issues with a movie that just attempts to shrug that off like it is not made in a context where this is the rule rather than the exception. This sort of nostalgia for an objectively horrific past. So it's odd that it just sort of skips that and goes straight, as you say, Sam, rightly, for the legislation that is current. And this just completely erases every bit of historical context that makes this relationship so complicated. I think somebody who is a younger generation than I am may even look at this movie and go like, what is Sidney Poitier so strict about? Why is he panicking? He's obviously perfect. He's the perfect partner for her. She wants him. He wants her. Right. Get married. And he makes a big deal. It was a big deal. He makes a big deal. She typically does not, because she is a privileged young woman from an upper class upbringing, and she doesn't see the problem, but he does. And we know why. But I wonder how that will age.
Mm-hmm. I have never watched it with my students, you know, because it's not one of those films that I would, but it's certainly a film that is still seen or held very highly by very many people that I know as this classic that broke with something that had never been done before and presents it in a somewhat authentic way, that it's a great movie about and a great conflict around mixed race couples and marriage. So it has also this esteem that it built up, I think, because of Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy's last film, obviously. It's also production history, and because of Poitier and his fame at the time, he played these type of characters that no one else before had been able to, and he had the star quality that an African-American actor just never had before, and was an Oscar winner and so on. So it had this symbolism as well. But it's strange to see that the film, or interesting to see that the film sits so badly with, partly with you and me, today, that we, when we actually watch the movie, it doesn't deliver on the reputation that it has. And I feel it lives off a reputation. Guess Who's Coming for Dinner? You think, oh, it's that film. And then when you watch it, it's really not. And it's an awkward film. I also thought that what you said about old Hollywood and productions from before, it's made in the late 60s, obviously, when Hollywood studios had major problems with classic Hollywood productions and stars. It's not quite the late 60s and independent cinema yet. So it has this strange score as well by Frank De Wall, with these songs that are so jarring and sweet. Saccharini. And there's this backdrop, which is one of my favorites, of San Francisco from the terrace, clearly painted on. And they have all these scenes there. It looks so bad, but at the same time, it's so quaint and nostalgic in a way about old Hollywood productions and how they used to do it, including, of course, having Hepburn and Tracy as the stars. So there's so much that I love about this film, but basically what comes out, if you look at it with our eyes from today, thematically, it's so wrong as well. So I feel very, very ambiguous about the experience.
I like a story about this movie. After Tracy had died and the Oscar event was held where they were both nominated, Katharine Hepburn didn't go. She never went to those events. And there's this beautiful quote that she said to have said when she was called up to tell her that she'd won it. She said, "Did Mr. Tracy win it too?" And when she was told no, she said in that Hepburn way that I could never imitate, "Well, I'm sure mine is for the both of us." I mean, that tells you, I think, a lot about the life that they led together. They were never, of course, formally together. I don't think Hepburn was the marrying kind anyway. But that's such a beautiful story, I always think.
Mm-hmm. It's lovely. Such a beautiful coda as well to their final movie and to that collaboration.
And they really are the saving grace of that rather awkward piece of filmmaking.
If nothing else, they certainly are.
They are.
Yeah.
And I think that's about time. Thank you so much for joining me on this adventure. Glad to have your company. Glad to have discussed these classic films, classic comedies.
Well, thank you, Julie. It was fun.
And I hope to see you next time in our next installment of A Summer of Collaborations on A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.